Okay. Any questions? Last week, all we did is, you may recall, well, we did lots of things. We went whispers from eternity endlessly. Anything else that, any questions or thoughts from last week? Okay. So we are now on the section of guru-disciple relationship, as you all know. And we have just read the whispers number 24 called My Guru. We spent all last week on it, so we won't go there again. What we're talking about now is attunement with the guru. And it is one of the most important and one of the most subtle and complicated issues to talk about. I touched on it at Sunday service because it's been in my mind a lot, partly because of thinking about this class and just because it comes to my mind all the time, because it's just such a key issue. On Sunday, I was quoting Swami from the Thursday before, which all of you may have all heard these already, but someone asked him at the Thursday satsang at Ananda Village last week about the practice of Kriya. His response was that when Master would talk in public, he would talk a great deal about Kriya. But when he would talk to those who had made some commitment, he talked almost primarily about attunement. And you know, we have one of the Sunday readings, which we come around to every year, and it sort of lists through how various disciples left the path, but they wouldn't have had to leave the path if they stayed in tune. And then he even mentions in there that certain disciple who really hardly ever meditated, but she was able to come even to God realization by her attunement with Master. And on Sunday, I talked about that from many angles in terms of willpower and so on. So I don't want to just repeat that because many of you were sitting there at that time. But if you are a disciple or trying to be a disciple, there's a few elements that have to be spoken about. We talk a great deal about, the divine nature of the guru-disciple relationship, how God knows who your guru is, and then once you get onto your spiritual path, there's a God-ordained relationship. But Swamiji, in the book The Revelations of Christ, and of course, Christianity, which often speaks against gurus in its church form, is the most guru-oriented religion in the world because it's entirely focused on one figure and the whole theology is that he will save you, which is just about the biggest definition of guru relationship that you can imagine. They just think of it from a different light. But one of the strong points that's often argued in a very fundamentalist approach to Christianity is the necessity for you to accept Jesus. And Swami remarks a little bit too candidly, perhaps for some people's taste, they never really talk about whether Jesus accepts you. There's just this presumption that if you declare that you accept him, then he'll just be honored to have you. And there's good reasons why it's not talked about that much, because people tend to fixate then on whether or not they're worthy. And a great deal of that kind of theology is that you're washed clean by the blood of Christ and it really doesn't make any difference if you're worthy or not because all your sins are forgiven. And so your own worthiness doesn't come into it. And then, of course, there's a lot of emphasis in that theology of living like a Christian. You know, once you're saved, you can't just go back to sin. You have to keep on in the righteous path. But there's another much more subtle reality. You know, I find myself quite warm tonight. Is it possible to open that door for some reason? Which is that we have to magnetize, we have to magnetize the Master's love to us. Now, if you think about this just a little bit, we go through many incarnations, countless incarnations. This is a little odd, but I'm going to have to sit down. I just don't seem to have the wherewithal to stand up. I feel just a little faint. I know it's all right. It's more that I just feel a little faint standing up, which is very peculiar. Okay, so you might have to sort yourselves out a little so that you can see me. The advantage of my standing is nobody has to crane. So move around a little if you need to. There, I just feel better now. Body didn't want to stand up. Thank you. Okay, now we're all coddled and all set in here. We'll just start all over again. This is much better. My brain is fine. My body just didn't want to stand up. We've spent a lot of incarnations, I mean countless incarnations, just pursuing all kinds of things other than God realization. And if you really think of it as a romance or a relationship, which on the level at which we live it really is, it's a divine romance that we're trying to shift as the object of our desire, the experience of bliss and the experience of God directly, and we're trying to magnetize that response. It's not enough if someone is not sure whether you're fickle or true. I mean, even in human life, if somebody just suddenly decides, oh yeah, after all these lifetimes of ignoring you and giving you no attention at all, now I'm interested. Any discerning lover would want to wait a little bit and see what you actually do. And how noble, how true, how consistent, how refined your actual response is on an ongoing basis. And so there's a quality of magnetism that we ourselves need to put out that makes that discipleship more than just an initiation. It's exactly comparable to getting married and having a marriage. Having a wedding and having a marriage. People can have a wedding, you can go through the sacrament, you can consider yourselves confirmed by law or even by God if you want to, but whether or not in all the years that follow that, there's actually a connection that really becomes a union of hearts, it depends on everything that happens afterwards. It's not just an automatic reality. So we go through this long and painful period of seeking in which we finally do have, we are brought to, and we'll talk a little bit tonight about how that flow happens. But once we're there, and once even we feel like we're in relationship to our God-intended guru, that's when the real effort begins. And if we really do believe, as all the scriptures tell us, that it is through that channel that our liberation will come, then it naturally has to follow that we pay an enormous amount of attention to every nuance of how that relationship has to play itself out. And that's what attunement is. And it's not just a question of kind of in a general way being a disciple and in a general way kind of having the general idea of what we're doing and then just continuing to sort of feed ourselves from wherever we feel like feeding ourselves. It's a very subtle energy that we're trying to stand within, and we need to be very attentive and loyal to it. And we need to always be asking ourselves whether the course of study, the actions we're doing, the way we're spending our time are bringing us, you know, into attunement with that, or are maybe even moving us in a direction we want to go, but not necessarily in exactly that vibration. I mean, that's the basic idea that we're talking about with attunement. So over the course of the next several weeks, I mean, I think it will be interesting to really try to understand this, because it's so hard to bring to a clear focus verbally. It's more of a feeling inside, but it's something we really need to work with. Now, the first thing that Swamiji talks about here is the concept of discipline in relationship to the word disciple. There's another very sweet word in Sanskrit, which is the word chela. And the connection with the word chela is that it means child, or the context is child. So we can also be chelas as well as being disciples. Our house and our community, you know, we call it Chela Bhavan, which means the house of the disciples. But we liked that word chela because of the sweet intimacy that it implies. But Swami doesn't start with the word chela here. He starts with the word disciple. as related to discipline. And he says, who are the disciples? In this case, he says, those who follow what the guru really tells you to do. If you call yourself a disciple but don't undertake the discipline that the guru offers you. Now, it isn't only that he's trying to emphasize any level of painful sacrifice here. But the word disciple, as related to discipline, in the context of attunement, is also understanding that we just have to bring things to a focus. I mean, sometimes people think of discipline as some kind of a negative reality, but a very positive expression of the word discipline is that we just bring things to a focus. If we live a very disciplined life, what we're living is a very focused life. Instead of allowing our energy to dissipate in all directions and year after year goes by and we have almost nothing to show for it, if we live a disciplined life, we have systematically accomplished something, whether it's accumulating, saving money on our salary, developing the ability to play the flute, learning how to meditate, becoming very serviceful, being a world champion athlete, whatever it might be. I was very impressed, and without even touching the controversy that has long surrounded Lance Armstrong as a cyclist, he was refuting in his autobiography, which I read, the idea that he takes drugs to enhance his performance by telling us his workout routine. And he told us what his workout routine was, which was pretty stunning to even think about. And then he added, that's my routine, he said, every day. And then he goes on to say, and by that I mean every day. I mean my birthday, I mean Christmas, I mean New Year's Day, I mean Thanksgiving, I mean every day. Essentially what he said is, I win because I work. I don't win because I do anything else. I just live a very disciplined life. Now, we also have this thought in our minds that we lose somehow by being disciplined. Well, in a sense, things have to be given up when we become disciplined. Certain things are given up, but it's in fact exactly the story of the Mahabharata, which led to the story of the Bhagavad Gita, the section called the Bhagavad Gita, in which Arjuna is very reluctant to engage in this war because he's going to have to kill his own cousins and he really doesn't want to do it. And if you come to the Bhagavad Gita through the whole context of the Mahabharata, which isn't necessary, but if you do, you realize that they've tried every other alternative and they've really been driven to this point. And when they're finally there on the battlefield after hundreds of pages that finally got them to the battlefield, for Krishna at that point to say, for Arjuna to say to Krishna at that point, maybe we should reconsider this. Even in the context of the Gita, it doesn't seem like a good idea, but in the context of the whole story, it really just seems outrageous. I mean, Arjuna, what do you want? What do you expect to happen? What do you think is going to happen that hasn't already happened? You know, this is our alternative at this point, and we must do it. And Arjuna's, what he symbolically represents there is every devotee, and the image of having to go to war and kill your own cousins on the field of Kurukshetra is within your own consciousness, having to actually confront those qualities which are working against you spiritually and have the impersonal self-discipline to simply cast them out of your life. In this case, he murders them on the battlefield. But we just have to decide. If we're going to go forward on the path of righteousness, we have to narrow our focus. That's just the way the human mind works. In order to go deep, it has to become focused. There was a great violinist, and after one of his concerts, someone said to him, oh, I'd give my life to be able to play like that. And the violinist responded, I have. You know, that's how come I play like this. I've given my life to being able to play like this. And if you want to really be in tune with a vibration as subtle and as elevated as a God-realized master, you have to actually give something to it. It's not just enough to accept Jesus Christ as your Savior. You have to also then draw Jesus' attention to you or Master's attention to you, the Guru's attention to you, and you do that by the quality of your attunement. And a better way to put it is like this, is that the the uplifting power of the master is always being projected. But if we don't vibrate in tune with that, it goes over us but not into us. I mean, it's the same way that the material world is manifested, that all these different material things, even though they're all vibrations of energy, they don't all melt together because they're all vibrating at different wavelengths, and so the wavelengths don't match and they stay separated. That's the why now they've begun to figure out that you can do things with sound waves, because they can dissolve kidney stones with sound waves, or a violinist or a singer can break a glass just with the sound of the voice or the sound of the instrument, because if they can get the two things vibrating at the same rate, then it will change. Well, in the case of the sound waves, it's a force. The force of the sound wave actually dissolves the kidney stones, which is really quite remarkable when you think about it. But it tells you that vibration is a force. So when the forces don't match, then you have all the separateness that we're experiencing. And even in our human relationships, you will say, you know, I just met this person today and we just felt so in tune with each other. We were doing creative work today and we were all on the same wavelength. You know, that's just how we describe things. Or I met someone and I just felt so dissonant with him today. There was just no harmony between us. All of these different words, which are all the vocabulary for what we intuitively perceive, which is there's some issue of vibration here. Swamiji made an interesting remark once. He said, very often when people don't understand each other, people who speak the same basic language, he said, the problem is a matter of rhythm. And he said, you know, black people who have a different rhythm in the way they speak, often black and white can't understand each other. The rhythms are very different. Accent is one thing, but the rhythm is something else. If you have a very speedy rhythm and you're trying to relate to people who don't have such a speedy rhythm, you'll find that if you change your rhythm to match theirs, that was something that a long time ago, it sort of occurred to me that I was expecting people to match my rhythm, and it just wasn't happening. But when I started trying to match their rhythm, then all of a sudden I found that communication, same words, but suddenly the words would match because the vibrations behind them were easier to go together. This is not exactly the same, but I was talking to an Indian man. I was just doing business with a travel agent, and he had a very pronounced Indian English, and India English, and I just couldn't understand him. And because I was just on the phone, I started speaking with his accent. You know, just a little bit, not enough to make him angry with me. But then I could understand him. Isn't it interesting? If I responded with the same nuance, then... Because Indian English is part accent and part rhythm. It's just a very different rhythm. So I started just kind of being in his rhythm, and then all of a sudden, I could understand him. It wasn't that he understood me, I understood him. Because all of a sudden, we were moving in the same way. Now, what the master is trying to give us is teachings and techniques. But above all, what the guru gives you, not just the teacher who helps you understand the principles, but what the guru gives you, is the guru actually magnetizes you, magnetizes us. He actually changes our essential vibration. And every time we've had anything that feels like a really deep and transforming spiritual experience, it's always because in some fundamental way, we just feel like everything has shifted. Just like everything shifts. And once the vibration of your consciousness shifts, then, you know, love is automatic, joy is automatic, optimism is automatic. And then when you lose that vibration, you go off into something else. That's why really, in the end, vibration is everything. I've shared with some of you, but it's notable in this context. The first really spiritual person I met was an Indian Swami of the Ramakrishna Order who was a guest speaker at the Vedanta Temple in Hollywood, in the Hollywood Hills, like 1966, 67, something like that. Maybe 67. He spoke. He was not an intellectually impressive speaker, although he was facile with words. couldn't quite understand his accent because I hadn't been to India and I hadn't heard that accent that much. I was very used to intellectual content, and I just couldn't find his intellectual content. But he just talked on in this most cheerful and magnetic manner, and the more he talked, the more and more just totally uplifted my consciousness was. And I was really trying, what I was trying to do was understand him, but I realized by some divine grace I was basically trying to tune into him. And the more I tuned into him, the more he took me into his space. And his space was just so joyful, just completely outside of all the little details that I was so concerned about. You know, that's why, I mean, the content of his talk was incidental. It was like he was just there to share these vibrations of happiness, and he was putting words on them so that we would all have something to do while he did it. But it was just the magnetism that we were receiving. And afterwards, we all, you know, lined up to shake his hand, as you do in a situation like that. And his eyes, I'd never seen eyes like that. You know, just, they were just somewhere else. Just so blissfully happy. And he shook my hand, you know, and you had the distinct impression that what he was looking at was not what you were looking at. But what happened was, and by the grace of God, instead of sitting there and holding on, which I could have, well, he's not a very impressive speaker. Well, I mean, what point is he trying to make? Well, goodness, I mean, hasn't he read Vivekananda's books? You know, it's like, that's not exactly how I read. I mean, I could have done all that. And doing all that would keep me on a particular vibration. But his magnetism was so strong, my desire, who knows, that we just attuned to each other. That was in person. You know, and then he went away. I've never seen him since. I don't know what his name was. But you see, I still remember. How long ago was that? You know, more than 40 years. But I can still see him. I can see his face. Because it was such a startling thing to realize. Now, the relationship with one's own guru is going to be, you know, much more ongoingly powerful than that. And what is it that we're really looking for? What we're really looking for is that shift of consciousness. And that's what we're doing. Everything that we do, all the study, all the practices, all the self-discipline, everything is for that shift of consciousness. And so what the master wants us to really understand is that that shift of consciousness, everything is to make you able to receive it. We think that all the other actions are an end in themselves. They're not. They're just an effort to bring our consciousness, to discipline ourselves and bring ourselves into alignment so that we can receive that vibration and be changed. In the West, you call it the grace of God. And actually in India, they call it the grace of God. It's the same thing, the Sanskrit words for grace you hear more often there, kripa. Swamiji's house in New Delhi is called Guru Kripa, meaning the grace of the Guru. That's the name of scratched into the nameplate on the house. So because that's how sort of the house came as the grace of the Guru there in New Delhi. Okay, yes. We can shut the door now. I seem to have recovered whatever was ailing me. Okay.
Before I forget, so when you were actually listening to this Swami talk, you said that, not clear, but you were saying that he actually helped you attune to himself? Or?
Well, he was there to give us vibrations above all. Mm-hmm. And he understood. I mean, his speech was fine, but you could tell that his primary focus wasn't on the concepts he was trying to put across. His primary sense of being there was that he was going to give us his magnetism. And he was just there, just giving out his magnetism. And his magnetism was great bliss in being in tune with Ramakrishna, who was the guru there. And so he talked, but he hadn't labored over his speech, and it just kind of bubbled out in all directions and didn't have a great deal of content. Because it didn't matter. Content, concepts that the intellectual mind could really enjoy, was a much lower order of sharing than the vibration of the perception of bliss he was having.
So how did you get attuned to him?
by good luck and God's grace. Because I could have, because I began to feel something from him, I could just feel this as I was sitting there wondering about what he was trying to say and what it meant, and, you know, just like not being impressed by his lecture. As part of me is like sitting there not being impressed by his lecture, there's also this other part of me that's just beginning to just feel so free and so happy and so uplifted and so conscious of the divine potential of life that I was very impressed by that experience, and I lost track of the other concerns. And I just went with his experience because it seemed really wonderful to me.
So your mind didn't start analyzing?
That's no, what it started out analyzing, but it was overcome by the other experience, and I just went with it. It wasn't a samadhi experience. I don't want to overdo it. But, you know, he was a very advanced soul, and his company was very uplifting. Now, you want to hear another one, which is completely different than this? There was this Swami, he's now passed away, an Indian man who lived in America for a while, and he came. There was a period of time when all the American Swamis, all the Indian Swamis who had come to America would come to Ananda Ashram, and because we were so gracious and humble, they thought that we were up for grabs, and so any one of them who wanted to increase their quota of disciples tried to harvest out of our ashram. And quite a few people were harvested out of our ashram, and Swami Kriyananda had to make a rule that no one could visit unless he was in town, because they tended to harvest when he wasn't there. This Swami came, whose name I won't mention because you won't even know it, doesn't matter. He was a very powerful man. And we were having a very good time with him. Swami Kriyananda was in India, I think. And, you know, just sort of hosting him and just enjoying the satsang. And then he gave this evening satsang, and he started talking about his own upbringing, which included having gone to the Himalayas at a young age and spent a lot of time with Himalayan yogis. A very interesting story. And I was just listening with my eyes closed, and I began to see what he was describing. And I don't mean I just, you know, was listening to him and had images. I actually began to see what he was describing. I was walking on the rocks. I was seeing the caves. I was really there. The first thing you think of is, wow, this is kind of neat. And then the second thing I thought of was, this man is in my mind. And then I thought, I didn't give him permission to come into my mind. And I don't really think I want him in my mind. And so I kind of pushed the experience away, and it just completely stopped at that moment. But it was like, you know, I had been very open with him all day, and I'd been accepting his energy in a very why not sort of way. But then I realized all of a sudden he was moving in on me. And a number of people in our community left with him. And I'm sure that he found their minds open to his. You know, but it was a different kind of attunement because I could feel him coming in. Do you know what I mean? There was like an action on his part to cross a certain barrier and like give me these visions. And I hadn't accepted him. See, now Yogananda says that he comes and he examines the consciousness of everyone, of his disciples, but he says, I do that because you've given me permission to do it. He said, otherwise I would never do it. It's an interesting distinction, isn't it? That there's nothing in it. There's, Master has no intention. But you see also, that subtlety of moving across that barrier when I hadn't invited him in is not a good sign. And in other ways, this man, I think, proved himself not to be entirely what he was aspiring to be. So the mere fact that something will come to you sometimes is not the only sign of whether things are good. You have to also look at it by other qualities. Because there was a quality of being, the only word I can use is sucked into something. And I didn't want to go there. But this other Swami, he was just emanating this blissful energy. And all of a sudden I found that I could lift myself up and be with him. It was completely invitational, but there was nothing intrusive about it. And it was strong enough for me to overcome my bias at that time toward intellectuality. But to be fair to myself, when I met Swami Kriyananda, I was magnetized to him immediately because of the vibration of his consciousness. He hadn't even spoken before I felt that. I felt the magnetism come into the room, and I felt very, very, I felt totally in tune with that magnetism. And so there's a very personal element here, in the whole thing as well. Does that make sense? I'm talking about this because this is the most important thing, just trying to give examples so that we can all... Somebody asked Swamiji, how can you tell if you're in tune? He said, the presence of joy. He said, joy is the sure sign of attunement. Which is just an interesting statement because we think it's so hard to figure out how are you in tune or not. He said, no, joy is the presence, is the sign. Not just happiness, but, joy is a different feeling. Bliss is a different feeling. It's an undercurrent. It's like a background song to whatever else is going on. No matter how miserable some moments may be, it's still something else. Huh. All right. Any other questions or thoughts? Yes, yeah, certainly, Edwin.
So it's not more, when you try to tune yourself, it's more vibrational than actually saying, okay, Master, I'm trying to tune myself to you, or...
No harm mentally. Telling him what your intention is, but at a certain point it's more like you either imagine the master's consciousness. Creative imagination is an important part of meditation. When you can't feel it, you kind of imagine it. And the way I feel it in myself is then you lift yourself into that vibration. And you consciously open yourself to it and try to merge your consciousness into that vibration. And you can chat a little bit while you're there. if it helps keep your consciousness there. But the conversation is just to keep your mind focused, keep your attention focused. It's also obviously when I say lift, because you have to really open your heart. It's your heart. Your vibration comes from your heart. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. It's all the meannesses of the heart. It's the meannesses of the heart that vibrate differently than the pure spirit. The mind follows the heart. Calming the heart is what results in the calm mind. So what keeps us from opening our heart is fear of being unworthy, fear of what might happen if we really let God in, fear of having to really actually give up all those little bad emotional habits that, even though they cause us pain, we're still attached to. Fear of having to really acknowledge. I mean, we sing that song every week, Long I Feared to Face Your Love, Lest My Emptiness It Prove. And that's a very subtle phrase because there's just sort of like we hold at bay. If you're very disappointed often in your life, you'll start saying, well, I don't really want it. How little children are. I didn't get it. I never wanted it. I didn't really want it, And so we get like little children. Well, I was disappointed in my romance. I was disappointed in my career. I was disappointed in myself. But we just say, I'm fine. It's fine. I really never wanted. I'm better off like this anyway. Because we don't want to see too clearly what we longed for and didn't get, because to see that may be such a painful contrast to what our present consciousness is that we just don't think we can bear it. So to really understand how much love and bliss is really available to us, sometimes we just don't want to know, because then we'll have to recognize what we don't have in the moment. That's what that song is. Long I feared to face your love, lest my emptiness it proved. Now at last my heart I give you. And then it says, who remain my, our friend. What that's saying is that God never changed. He just waited for us to be able to have the courage to really do that. So when we're lifting, what we're really lifting is we're lifting all of those limitations. Because unless we lift them, we can't attune our consciousness.
I think that's the problem. I'm having problems when you say lifting it. Yeah, that's why I ask you, do we have to like imagine if I can't feel lifting it up? Or
well, you imagine it. I mean, your consciousness is here, which by nature is going to lift. If your attention is here, your heart is obviously going to be lifted. But you can kind of also, you know, you do kriyas. You know what the heart feels like. I mean, you can imagine that lotus turning upward and that energy flowing. It's the kriya. That's what that. I mean, what we're doing with the kriya is we're gathering all our energy and we're lifting it up to the spiritual eye. I mean, why are we doing that? Because we're trying to gather all our energy and lift it up to the spiritual eye. And the kriya kriya is not mechanical, but the kriya technique is the mechanics of gathering all that energy and lifting it up to the spiritual eye, because that's what we have to do. Because all the energy that's held in those vrittis in the chakras is held away from merging with that vibration. Because by definition, those vrittis are vibrating at a different frequency than the pure light of spirit at the spiritual eye. So we just keep doing those kriyas, we interiorize, we strengthen, we circulate that energy until we can, with our willpower, lift that energy. Even as you do your kriyas, we talk about doing your kriyas with a corresponding effort to be in tune. So if you do your kriyas, because Swamiji in that same satsang, as I said on Sunday, he mentioned that there was that German man. He said he was German because he had so much willpower. Who had done at least 1,000,000 kriyas, Swamiji said, in the few years that Swami was there. But he never did the kriyas with a corresponding effort to be in tune. He just concentrated on the kriyas. I mean, who knows? I wasn't inside his body, but this is the implication. Whereas when you're lifting those kriyas, you're not just using your willpower to draw that energy to a focus. You're lifting your energy into attunement with the master. And that makes the whole thing completely different. Because then it's not just you putting in your time or you using your willpower. It's gathering yourself and offering it up into the master.
That's the devotional part.
That's the devotion. That's where kriya becomes completely devotional. Plus, it's just more effective. Because then you're not just imposing your will on the universe. You're recognizing that enlightenment comes from the guru, not just from my own will, from attunement with the guru. Is much more interesting then. Okay, does that answer it?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Actually, the word guru right here comes from Sanskrit gur, to raise, to uplift. So we do our part to lift ourselves to the master, and the master takes us the rest of the way. It's the oddest thing, because one does have to put out, this is the way Master put it. Oh, there's so many things that, I was talking about this on Sunday, there's so many things that you can say that make a certain amount of sense but don't really make sense until you have the experience that tells you what they really meant. We say that all transformation comes from the grace of God, and you sort of say that, but then you just sort of keep trudging away to change yourself, and then suddenly you actually change. And you realize that it was the grace of God. There's no other way to say it. It's like there's no point at which you yourself made yourself different. You just were one way and then you were another way. And there's an astonishing sense of it having just come from nowhere and being done to you. Even if you've done 1,000,000 kriyas, the feeling of it is that you've been liberated from something rather than that you have extricated yourself from something. So then you start saying things like, it's just the grace of God. Even though people have, looking at you from the outside, think that you did something for it, but the way it feels inside of you, it's just the grace of God. It just comes. Somehow when that attunement is there, it just comes. That makes sense? This is such a sweet story he tells in here where the guru told the disciple to go on a pilgrimage to all the holy places of India. And then the disciple walked 3 times around his guru and then sat down and said, well, I've been everywhere there is worth going. It was just a very dear story. Okay. Then he has, Swamiji has really a very interesting 3-part little story here where he says that there's basically 3 stages that we all go through, you know, in our effort to come to realization. And it's helpful to see this because nothing is really, for us, nothing is absolute. We're always sort of doing everything at once. It also helps us in our effort to help others because we can understand more what is the appropriate next step for someone else. Sometimes we imagine that the appropriate next step for someone else is the same step that I'm taking. And the first thing he says, a person comes to understanding through many stages. The first stage is the world is your guru. And he doesn't mean by that you're out and the whole big world is teaching you. It's rather different than that. Because what really helps us to learn is we have to go through this process of what causes us suffering and what brings us bliss. So we have to go through the school of hard knocks, so to speak, where we just have to keep working with the world, in the world, without having this life raft yet of being able to cling to the master. And we just have to try to make our way as best we can. Now, we think that, we may think that the world is unfair, all sorts of things. But in fact, there's a process that's happening to the soul, which is that we're having actions and its consequences, actions and their consequences, actions and their consequences in one incarnation, in many incarnations, until the lessons get driven deeper and deeper inside. And everyone that you know and yourself, I mean, you know this too, there's just certain things that you know. And you can see people who just don't know those things. You know, if you overspend, if you make a certain income and spend more than you earn and end up in debt, that's really not going to work for you. If you're very unkind and self-centered in the way you relate to people, you're not going to end up with a lot of friends. If you become too dependent on physical beauty and time passes and you lose it, you know, that's really not going to work for you. Somebody sent us this photo record of Queen Elizabeth. I mean, I don't know if you haven't seen it, go wherever you go on the internet and find it. Look up Queen Elizabeth and the Presidents of the United States. They had a picture of Queen Elizabeth with every president of the United States that she's been in relationship to, which I won't spoil the joke by telling you how many there were. But you also watch her age right in front of your eyes. You know, she was, when she started, she couldn't have been much more than 20. She looked really, really young. And now she's 80 at least. 85. But you know, what's amazing is to watch her age, you know, through these pictures. Or first she youths and then she ages. You go back up from the bottom. But you just watch the human body disintegrate right in front of you. Everybody's does. But we imagine somehow that it's not going to happen to us. But it happened to Queen Elizabeth. It's going to happen to everyone. So we go through this this school of hard knocks. Are you looking? Didn't I send it to you? I thought I did. No, okay. Anyway, I'm sure if you go onto Google and look up Queen Elizabeth and Presidents of the United States, because I bet it's one of those things that's going to go everywhere. But what I was saying is experiences happen to us. And we suffer. I mean, think how many times our hearts have been broken, just even we can remember it in this lifetime, by death or other separations. Just our heart breaks. And then we either think, well, suffering is my lot, or we begin to really wonder if there's anything that can be done about this. In Autobiography of a Yogi, there's that extremely touching story about Kumar, who was the disciple who came to Sri Yukteswar's ashram. Kumar was his name, I believe. Am I correct in that? And Kumar was somehow, he held Sri Yukteswar's heart. I mean, he attracted Sri Yukteswar's affection and his determination to help him. Yogananda says that Kumar's charm was lost on the other ashram inmates, but somehow or another he had the karmic capability of winning Sri Yukteswar's desire to help him. But eventually Kumar just proved himself. He disregarded Sri Yukteswar's advice and went back to his old village and then fell into worldly habits and finally had to be asked to leave the ashram. Sri Yukteswar couldn't bear to ask him to leave. He had to have Yogananda do it. But then he says this phrase, the world will have to be his guru still. Meaning, here I am. He didn't speak of himself in such self-centered terms, but here was Sri Yukteswar, an avatar, a fully realized master, who was offering to help this boy, you know, come out of all that misery that wrong living induces, but Kumar didn't want it. He wasn't in tune with it. He didn't want it. He didn't recognize what he had. And so Sri Yukteswar just had to accept that he's still at the first stage. The world will be his guru still. He's just going to have to knock around through many incarnations until he's ready to have this come. So all of us do this. And when you see people doing it, you can't really make them be otherwise. If they haven't actually figured out that this is not going to give me what I think it's going to give me and that I need to begin to at least think from an inside point of view, you can't force people to do that. When we try to decide what the cultural demographic of people who come to Ananda is, which has always been really hard to pin down, the one thing that I think is consistent is that everyone who is even slightly attracted to what we're doing here has begun to think that somehow the answer is inside. That even no matter how advanced or elementary they are in that inclination, or how sophisticated or unsophisticated they are in the understanding of it, the external world has taught them enough for them to understand that it's self-mastery that I have to seek now. It's not through imposing my will or achieving my goals in an external way. Somehow it has to come from within. And that's what Swamiji is describing here. First stage is the world is your guru. And then, he says, the second stage is man begins to wonder about God. But we're going to take a break before we go there. Okay? Okay. I presume there's no questions, or if there are, we'll take them. Anything? Okay. Good, then let's go on. The first stage, the world is your guru. The second stage is man begins to wonder about God. And you have to realize that the Festival of Light that we do every week, the little allegory about the bird, this is exactly what the bird is talking about. The bird goes out. He's manifested by the divine. That's his mission. Be fruitful and multiply, and the gifts that, you know, that you manifest and share with others as we have shared with you. That's what the divine says in the story. It's a little bird thrown out of the nest by his parents. But then the bird decides that this is pretty nifty, flying out here on my own. And this feels really terrific to be so powerful. And look at all that I can do. I can fly. I can acquire things. I can make things happen. I can be a big, important force in the world. And the bird just forgets that he has any other higher purpose than that. And even though repeatedly the bird lost everything he has, he still thinks that he's in charge of his destiny and that he needs to stay that way. That's the cycle of time when the world is your guru. But then eventually, everything, as he puts it, as we put it in the allegory, night falls and it gets dark. I mean, that's a way of saying that it just stops working for him. And he just doesn't know where he's going or what he's doing. He cries out, how can I fly in this darkness? Meaning that a certain amount of confusion is set in and the old system isn't working. I mean, that's what happens. You live in the world and everything is fine, but then somehow it stops working. And that doesn't mean even that you're not successful. It just means that it stops working for you. And you don't even know why it's not working, but it's just not working. You may have gotten everything you want, and then somehow you still feel miserable, and you just don't understand why. You don't know how you can go on in this darkness because you're so confused. And then the night suggests that you surrender. Peace awaits you in the unknown. And then you enter the stage which is called the quest. And the quest is a marvelous concept, because prior to the time that you're on a quest, you're not on a quest. You're just making it work for yourself. You're not asking any questions. And when you're dealing with people who are not asking questions, you can't answer their questions. They're not asking them. And when I asked my mother before she died, I said, she was toward the end of her life, and she was not philosophically interested. Mother, how do you feel about dying? I hate to think of all this going on and my not being here to be part of it. That was her response. Oh, that's marvelous. I mean, you know, where are we going to go from there? There's just no conversation. I asked my elderly uncle, you know, are you afraid of dying? Why should I be afraid? Nothing happens. It's just poof, over. Okay, that's just fine, you know. You'll just keep doing that for a while and see if that works for you. But there comes a point where somehow, as Yogananda puts it in the Autobiography of a Yogi, the whole thing assumes a certain, here's his fantastic phrase you've all heard, anguishing monotony. Just anguishing monotony, and that's just so much worse than tragedy. Tragedy is at least exciting. Anguishing monotony is just what really pushes you over the edge. So you begin the quest. That's what we say every week. You begin to ask the question, what is going on here? Everything I thought was real has proved not to be. Who are we in reality? For what end were we made? Swami puts it here, man begins to wonder about God. And it's not that you know God or even have faith in God, but it crosses your mind that maybe something is going on here. And that's where East-West comes in. You know, that's where our bookstore comes in, and people can just go and start looking for things. I went to East-West before I found Ananda, and before Ananda owned East-West, because I was wondering about God. And East-West was entirely a bookstore up in Menlo Park, and I would go there very frequently and wander around because I was wondering about so many things, and they could be answered there. And that period of the quest is still not the same as actually having a relationship with God. When we were writing our website, when Karen and David were writing it and I was helping them by responding to what they did, it was really a big question. It's like, who are the people that we're trying to attract? And I felt that she hit it just perfectly. She says, have you ever wondered about God? That's one of the first lines on our website. Because that pretty much draws them in. Because if they haven't, then they can just go on to the next website. Because they have to at least have wondered about God. Or else they're not us. It helps if you've done a little more than that. But that was the broadest opening that they could think of that would bring people in. So then you start really wanting to have real answers. And and this is where Swami says, you read books, you attend lectures, and you try to find something that will satisfy, first of all, your mind. You want good answers. And that's when you ask real intellectual questions. Actually, it was you who sent me that question about ego and God and guru. And without, you know, being too specific about it, it was somebody who had been speculating on whether God exists and whether the guru exists and whether it's just the ego as a trick. And my answer was, you don't ask someone about these things if they're still wondering whether they're there or not. You have to ask someone who has some actual experience of God and some qualification to be a guru. However, such speculation suits a certain stage on the quest. Where you haven't become at all convinced that these things are actually real And if that's sincerely where one is standing, then you talk about it with lots of people. Is God real? Does the guru really exist? Is there such a thing? And you hear people just talking and talking and talking and speculating and exercising their own creative imaginations, you know, just trying to guess. And lots of such teachers are very, very popular. They don't speak with any authority. And in fact, it's a principle with them not to speak with authority on these things. Some are more or less egotistical in that position. But being only at that stage of understanding, they don't know that there's a stage beyond it. And just trying to think it out, they can't really see where it's going to go. That's why, again, when I was talking on Sunday, I was saying only a certain number of questions could be answered, because after that, the only answer is to do Kriya, which is to say to practice, change your consciousness. But many people for a long time, because it's a stage on the spiritual path, are content just to speculate. And they don't want to actually even do any practices until they can satisfy their speculation. But they can't satisfy their speculation without doing practices. But what they are then is they are looking at all the menus in all the restaurants, but they're not really that hungry. Because you do reach a certain point where you're just too hungry to just talk about this anymore. It just won't satisfy you. So, and this is exactly what he says, you can become laden with theological theory, but your heart is not satisfied. I recall thinking of East-West and thinking of those early years before I met Swamiji, which was all before 1969. I was intensely interested, and I was actually by that point pretty hungry. But I couldn't find any restaurant that was open. It's the only thing I could think about, putting it like that. But I began to become extremely interested in how people actually lived a spiritual life. I mean, the theory I had gotten down as far as I needed to get it down, it wasn't that I by any means knew the teaching of self-realization, but I'd gotten the point. I understood what was happening, but I couldn't find anybody. I mean, this one Indian Swami crossed my path and then just disappeared out of my life forever. But I couldn't find anything around me that looked enough like me that was also doing an actual spiritual life. But I haunted East West Bookshop, and I just read through the whole section on saints, because I figured that those were the people. And I read the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and I just started reading about saints, because I got that somehow or another they'd done something different. And I mean, I didn't read that many, but I read East and West just trying to find one, find the clue, as because the heart was not satisfied. But then he says the third stage is you're finally drawn to one who knows God. In other words, when the disciple is ready, the guru comes. Because until we're really interested in attuning our vibration with a completely different vibration, we're not really going to get anything from the guru anyway. Or let me phrase it differently, he's not going to be able to give us anything. So we'll read all the books, and we'll get all this theory really figured out, and we'll talk about it, we'll have great fun, but then something will happen, and we'll suddenly, it'll become a living relationship. And one way or another, Master will find us. And you know the stories. It's so much fun to just sit around with people and ask, how did you ever get here? How did you find out about Master? What did you do? One of my favorite was told to me by this man who was standing on a street corner in a city like Chicago, a big city, not even in a particularly nice part of town, but there was a bookstore across the street, and for some reason that bookstore had a big poster of Master in the window. But the blinds were almost completely closed, but they were open just where Master's eyes were. So he actually was standing on a street, and I think in a fairly not particularly elevated condition himself, and he looked across the street, and these eyes were looking at him out the window of this closed store. He had no idea who they were or what it was or anything, and he couldn't find out because the store was closed. So, you know, as soon as he was able, he came back and saw that it was a big picture of Master, and he got the autobiography, and then everything else happened from that. But, I mean, can you imagine? But just how precise that is? And it wasn't really as if, in any really big external way, his life looked like he was seeking that much. But he suffered a lot and was inwardly longing, and God knew that. I asked Swamiji once, you know, how can people really make any progress when they're just out in the middle of Wyoming just reading books? His answer pretty much was, they don't, he said. But when they're really, really, when their heart really wants more, then it will come to them. I remember Swami was giving a talk once in the Bodhi Tree bookstore in Southern California. It was very, very crowded. It's sort of a small venue there, and it was really crowded. And they had pictures of many saints and masters around the walls. And there was a young man in there, and he was trying to decide, this was many years ago, he was trying to decide if he should go to India to see Sai Baba, because he really felt drawn to Sai Baba. He just couldn't make up his mind what to do. And Swamiji was talking about the fact that you go through this process, and when the disciple is ready, the guru will make himself known to you. And just as he said that, there was a picture on the wall, and the boy hadn't realized that he'd sat right under Sai Baba's picture. Sai Baba's picture came off the wall, did a full somersault, and fell face up on his lap. Really. It really happened. Just boom, just like that. All of a sudden, just as he's saying, when the disciple's ready, the guru will come. Whack. On his lap. Every so often, you know, the masters just take a really direct hand in things and want us to know. Isn't that something? So what this also tells us is the explanation of why an autobiography of a yogi, when Master says the characteristic feature of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship. Because the guru is always present, but what makes the relationship is when the disciple is ready. Because the guru could make himself known to you and you won't even see him. I personally had autobiography of a yogi. I owned it because in the course of my seeking, it would be only natural to have come to that book. I actually tried to read it. I read just a few pages, you know, but it's quite full of miracles. And I don't really know if I made it past Lahiri Mahashaya manifesting in the wheat field, which is, I believe, on page 9 of the book. And I just remember my feeling about the book was, it was just too miraculous. And it wasn't even that I didn't believe in miracles. I had an even snootier reason why I wasn't interested, is that I didn't want a phenomenal path. I wanted a very straight, I didn't want anything that was too fluffy. I just wanted the straight story. As a devotee of Vivekananda at that point. But I met Swami Kriyananda, and he was a disciple of Master. And everything about Kriyananda just totally impressed me. And he was a disciple of Master, so, you know, that behooved me to follow that thread. I just picked up Autobiography of Yogi. I loved it. And it was even like, it hadn't been that much before when I couldn't even read it. It was like Swami Kriyananda's vibration put me in tune with Yogananda's vibration. And all of a sudden I could find it. Swami has said that many of us are disciples of Yogananda through him. And somehow his consciousness magnetizes Yogananda's consciousness to us. And we're able, I mean, certainly that was my own experience. I just couldn't find Yogananda until I saw Kriyananda. And then Yogananda was perfectly obvious after that because the energy was there. So, finally, one is drawn to one who knows God, is how Swami puts it. When the desire becomes very intense, when the devotee is ready, the guru appears. And then Swami tells us how when Master was living, many of the disciples would ask the obvious question, because not everybody came young. There was that man who said that he saw Master. Master gave a lecture to, was it, this was a, the name escapes me at the moment, but one of the devotees of Master, that Master came and gave a lecture in a hall in some American city, and this man was there. I think he was sitting in the balcony. There were 5,000 people present, and this man said he felt like Yogananda gave the whole lecture to him, just directly to him. Yogananda's response was, "I remember." Because he saw him. He saw one of his true disciples there. All those other people, you know, were there, but he saw one of his disciples. I think his name was Rogers. Oliver Rogers, is that correct? Anyway, he was looking right at him. But then it was 25 years before he actually came back to Master. And then he finally found his way. So people would ask, "Why didn't I come sooner?" And Master would say, "Well, you weren't ready. You know, there was just other experiences that we had to have before we were able to do this." You just have to trust that God is in charge. And even though on one hand it's discouraging, Master also tells us that fabulous story about the woman who didn't meet him till she was in her 80s. But she just devoted herself with such concentration from that point on that she actually attained liberation in that lifetime. Because once she found him, nothing else existed for her, and all of her energy was devoted. She became a perfect disciple, which is utterly disciplined to it. So part of us, we also have to realize, is when you have the opportunity to really come to a really serious and good path, you can't just kind of be casual about it and think that these things come every day to everyone. You know, you have to, there's a moment in time when these opportunities are here, and we have to really apply ourselves with real focused energy in order to draw from the path. And that's why then the question of attunement becomes really important. What are we going to do? How are we really going to live here? Let me just look in one more case. Swami also explains when he says the world will be our teacher. He says in all cases God is the guru. And then he puts it this way. First, through his law, which is another way of saying the world will be your teacher. What's really teaching you is the karmic law, which is that one has to recognize that the world is not subject to our whims, but that there is a divine law that is operating at all times, and no matter what we do, gradually we begin to see that is really the force. And he teaches us through the impersonal operation of the karmic law. And since it happens, unfortunately, over many incarnations, it does take as many incarnations to finally catch it. But it's just astonishing in the course of one lifetime how many people are at the top for a while and then at the bottom and then at the top and then at the bottom. There was some, just, you know, one of those email things that goes around about some meeting of all the most powerful men in the world, and 25 years later, not one of them. Most of them were destitute even. I mean, just like it's the wave is up, the wave is down, and there's always a law behind it. So it's the law that disciplines us. It teaches us the limitations of the ego. Because you have to at least have some understanding of the limitations of the ego before you're willing to try to attune yourself with another vibration. Otherwise, that feeling of personal power that the little bird was experiences, it's exhilarating. It's exhilarating is what it is. That's why teenagers can be so just crazy, because they're just getting into that feeling of their personal power, and they just fly with that energy if they have no common sense. Then after the law comes books and, as he calls, other teachers. And often in our course, before we really find our place, we have other teachers to help us, even true and elevated teachers. But they're just bringing us to the point where we can really magnetize to ourselves a real God-realized master, which is where all those who are disciples of Master have come to after many, many incarnations. And it's the greatest blessing in the three worlds, as Shankara put it, because it really will give us the power to escape from this altogether. So that's the beginning. Any other questions or thoughts? All right, that's it for tonight.